So this is an image from Doctor Who. Doctor Who is a British science fiction program about a Time Lord. And this is from one of the series a couple of years back where he goes to a planet in orbit of a black hole, and it's called The Impossible Planet. But I chose it mainly because it looks really good. It's a great black hole. And so that's the reason for it. And that's what it is. So obviously you guys don't get Doctor Who here, that's clear. All right. So what I'd like to do today, and you know, do feel free to ask questions whenever. I wasn't quite sure of the audience, so I'm sure some bits are going to be very familiar to some of you, and some bits are also going to be very naive to some others of you. But the basic story that I want to tell is about brain world black holes. So brain worlds are a particular paradigm that we have for hiding extra dimensions. And it turns out that finding black hole solutions in these brain worlds is quite a tricky topic. And so that's the story I want to tell you a little bit about some of the work that I've been doing on it. And to finish off with this paper down here, I wrote with two other people at Durham, Simon Ross, who's would probably be very happy to use this technique, Canadian, and Robin Zegers, who's perhaps being French, less happy to use this hockey stick, where we were trying to test something called a holographic conjecture. So hopefully, you know, by the end of the talk, at least you'll sort of have some idea of what the story is and why brain world black holes are interesting but a bit tricky. So to start off, I just want to just been talking about salesmanship, I think, over lunch, and you always have to say, don't you, exactly what you're going to do before you do it. So I'm going to start off by giving a review about brain worlds, and I'm going to do it very much with the aim of introducing things that are relevant to the problem of black holes on brains. So directly, I'm going to talk a bit about brain gravity, finding some direct results about brain gravity. And I also want to say a little bit about brain cosmology, because this also brings in some ideas about black holes. And then I'll also want to say a little bit in general about black holes with extra dimensions, because, you know, as soon as you add in extra dimensions, the story with black holes becomes a lot more interesting and more complicated. And then I'll get to the actual guts of the story. So I think usually we don't often question why we think of extra dimensions, but I think perhaps we should, in the sense that it's not a very natural thing to do to have extra dimensions. Three space dimensions work extremely well. So, you know, why do we want to try and keep having these extra dimensions? Well, of course, we know we want to have extra dimensions because we are trying to find some unified description of nature. And again, you know, we sort of gravity, which is very much the perspective that I'm giving, you know, coming from when I give this talk. I'm very much a sort of gravitational physicist. Gravity does seem stubbornly classical. And if we want to unify gravity with the rest of particle physics, we do seem to be led to extra dimensions. So the first clue, obviously, it's all very familiar, but it's always nice to start, you know, with something everybody knows. About 90 years ago, Palutzer and Klein, which I'd love to know why they thought of this, but, you know, it's really, if we think about the way modern physics is now, it's really hard to imagine before Palutzer and Klein. So they unified the two long-range classical forces of the time, gravity and electromagnetism, by adding an extra circle to space-time. And so this circle realizes the gauge group of electromagnetism very directly, in a very nice way. It's geometric. And we get, if we look at our geometry, our five-dimensional classical gravity, general relativity, our geometry, we get something that looks like four-dimensional gravity, which is just things going along the hose pipe, if you like. And we get electromagnetism, which is things which sort of twist around, if you like, have some velocity around the extra dimension. But it's not quite Einstein gravity, because of course we have a scalar mode representing the size of the extra dimension. And the basic idea of Kaluza and Klein, or what we now call Kaluza-Klein theory, is that you hide extra dimensions by making them small, and you average everything over the extra dimension. Things are smeared. To contrast, brain worlds are sort of the opposite in a sense. In a brain world, we're very localized in the extra dimensions. And so my image for a brain world comes from a computer game that my son's fairly keen on, called Super Smash Brothers, which has this character, Mr. Game & Watch, who's two-dimensional. So Mr. Game & Watch must have been a character from the sort of very first generation of computer games. I don't know. I mean, probably the sort of thing that, had I been a teenage boy, I would have played. But since I'm not, I didn't. So I've no idea who Mr. Game & Watch was. But nonetheless, the general gist is, here's this two-dimensional character playing in a three-dimensional world, interacting with three-dimensional characters. And this is really what brain worlds are. They're lower dimensional objects. However, of course, because gravity is really about geometry, if you've got an extra dimension, gravity knows about it. So gravity is different, and if you want to see the extra dimensions, then it's gravity that you've got to look at. So, of course, we come across brains all the time in string theory, so we could say, why would you have a brain world? And one way of saying, well, maybe you do get brain worlds, because if you believe in string theory as your theory of quantum gravity, then you're led to having these brains. You can either have your D brains if you're looking at sort of standard 10-dimensional string theory, or, although I won't really be looking at this picture at all, there's also a brain world description from M theory if you have a heterotic type of compactification across an interval. So this is very much a sort of domain wall type of brain world, whereas these brains can have any number of extra dimensions. So why did brain worlds become very popular about a decade ago? Well, the reason was phenomenology, which is sort of quite a new development that phenomenologists actually care about gravity, but that's the way it is now. We want to hide the extra dimensions, but it was realized that if we had a brain world setup, it was possible, if we're localized, that perhaps the extra dimensions can actually have some significant size. And then if you do that, what happens, if you flip backwards and forwards, is standard particle physics just propagates in our brain, but gravity feels all these extra dimensions. And so relatively, gravity is weakened. And so this is a possible geometric description or resolution of the hierarchy problem. Perhaps not the most natural one, but at least it's an interesting alternative. And so what happens with brain world gravity is it gives us some different behavior on small scales, but we also have another inviting thing from a cosmological perspective is it can give us different gravity on large scales. So by taking an anti-Kaluza-Klein picture, this brain world picture, it sort of opens the door to all sorts of different gravitational phenomena. So that's why brain worlds have attracted quite a lot of attention. So just to, again, wrap up, emphasize the compare and contrast brain worlds with Kaluza-Klein as a method of hiding extra dimensions. In Kaluza-Klein, we envisage our extra dimensions being very small, and we tend to sort of average things. Things don't tend to depend, at least our geometry doesn't depend on the extra dimension. Whereas in brain worlds, we can potentially have large, sometimes even infinite, extra dimensions, and we are strongly localized. And if we do things in a self-consistent fashion, gravitationally, what we discover is that our geometry usually warps into the bulk, it curves in the bulk. So it's a very different sort of geometry to Kaluza-Klein gravity. So why black holes? I've sort of given a very cursory overview of brain worlds. So I can think I've sort of come up with three reasons why I think you should be interested in thinking about black holes with extra dimensions. I'm going to focus on the last one because I suppose when fundamentally I'm a theorist, but there's still some very good experimental reasons for trying to think about what happens to black holes when you have extra dimensions. So it's possible, I mean, again, possible, theoretically, that black holes can, even large black holes, even astrophysical black holes, might be able to probe large extra dimensions. So it's what normally, if you're looking at black holes in astrophysics, one of the ways in which you might investigate, it's not, at the moment it's not precise enough to be conclusive, but nonetheless, one can imagine in the not-too-distant future that it will be, is what astrophysicists look at are accretion disks around very, you know, very compact objects, which in some cases are believed to be black holes. And, you know, an accretion disk is essentially all this stuff, as you can see in the top corner, which has been sucked into the black hole. And so, because of all this matter on the accretion disk, you can model it by having the various individual components going round in approximately circular geodesics. So this is a very broad brush picture. But we know if we look at the geodesic equation in, say, the Schwarzschild background, we can write it in terms of a radial coordinate moving in an effective potential. So the effective potential has this standard general relativistic form. We've got the term that's there in Newtonian gravity. We've got our centrifugal repulsion, and then we've got the general relativistic piece that eventually wins out and tells you, in essence, that there's a black hole there. And so far enough away, we have a minimum, and we have stable orbits. Too close to the event horizon, and you can't orbit safely, hence the impossible planet of the Doctor Who being too close in. And in between these two branches, of course, there's an inflection point in the potential. And this, at this point, you have what's called an innermost stable orbit. And so this is like this sort of edge of the accretion disk. Things are being sucked in all the time, and eventually they sort of fall off this innermost stable orbit and get pulled right into the black hole. And so that's what's being measured, if you like. And the location of this innermost stable orbit is dependent on the solution. So in this case, this is just Schwarzschild, and so it's simply equal to 3 Schwarzschild radii. But if you have angular momentum, this alters. And so if you have any sort of alteration between the relationship between mass, angular momentum, due to your extra dimensions, then there's a possibility, at least hypothetically speaking, that even in the case of large black holes, you could probe these extra dimensions. Of course, the real headlines are being grabbed by the possibility of small black holes at the LHC. I have to admit, I'm a diehard skeptic about this, but I think most people are. So I mean, there the argument is simply that if exactly, well, yeah, let's not go into the reasons for skepticism. So why might a black hole form at the LHC? Well, there's this conjecture in classical relativity called the Hoop conjecture, which is more an intuition about when black holes form. And it's been any time you actually try and hammer away at the Hoop conjecture, you come up with what you think is a crafty plan to sort of form something where you've got a distribution which hasn't got an event horizon, but is still concentrated within its Schwarzschild radius. Something always goes wrong. So it's something that hasn't been proven, but it's every example that you find seems to back it up. And I won't make any comments about string theory at this point. So in this case, we say the horizon forms if in all directions your mass is concentrated within the Schwarzschild radius, a hoop which has the Schwarzschild radius. So, you know, the hula hoops that you play with, I was imagining putting the hoop around a mass distribution. And so if you put in the numbers for having n extra dimensions, this is what you find. If your energy scale, or the inverse energy scale, is less than the Schwarzschild radius, which has this sort of general form, then you'll get a black hole. And so this really just says, if your energy probes into the higher dimensional Planck scale, you generically might expect a black hole. At least these are the arguments that I guess whoever this guy is that's suing CERN is trying to use. Okay, that's one possible motivation. Although, in fact, it opens all sorts of interesting questions about this Hoop conjecture, because it does seem as if simulations looking for when horizons form seem to be throwing up some quite interesting and contradictory results. It's not at all clear that, in fact, this Hoop conjecture does work. But watch that space. The numerical people. Well, Matt Chopchuk's been doing some work having these scalar solitons and smashing them together. And if they're moving slowly, they seem to form a horizon. But when they speed them up, at some point, you don't get the horizon. They kind of do the usual soliton-y thing of, going through each other, which sort of kind of curious. I mean, my sort of way of thinking about it might be that, yes, you've got to be within the Hoop, but there's also a sense of timing involved. So if you're going too fast somehow, you can't, I don't know. It's all very wavy. It's very hard wavy. But I think it's great, because with all the, the new codes that people have, you're actually beginning to test some of these things. So it's great fun. Classical calculations, absolutely. I mean, I'm not convinced anybody's done anything, with the inelastic scattering. I mean, really thought about what might happen. In fact, I think they haven't. Sorry? Yes, it has to be, because you've got them coming in this direction, and they are, you've got an axis of symmetry.
Okay. But I think the actual code for written for 3+1, they're thinking about it because it's just a profile.
Yeah. Since people here obviously know about it, are they writing that up yet? Or is it one of these,
I have not heard.
They're probably not afraid of these.
I forget the fellow's name. A fellow in Japan wrote up a paper, but I haven't seen anything from Matt or France or anything.
I think it's completely orthogonal to bring up black holes. But I mean, I think it is an interesting, an interesting issue, because certainly if you go to quasi-static situations with gravity, it seems you just fail to get past the Hoop conjecture. And so but these are really highly relativistic. So it's kind of really like to see the finished product. So finally, and this will be the theme of what I'll be talking about later, is that there's actually quite an interesting theoretical reason for thinking about black holes on brains. And that is because in the particular model that I'll be talking about, there is a sort of, it's a slightly optimistic, but there is a link between the brain world model and the ABS-CFT conjecture in string theory. And this possible motivation for looking at black holes on brains is that perhaps you can actually get insights into quantum correct black holes in 4 dimensions by looking at classical solutions in 5 dimensions. So normally in ABS-CFT, you're actually doing ABS, your bulk theory, in your higher dimensions, 5 in our case, and your CFT is sort of on the boundary in 4 dimensions, and I guess the experts in the audience can tell me, but I guess you usually don't have gravity on the boundary. Whereas your brain is not on the boundary, the brain is actually sort of truncating the ABS at some finite value, and you do have gravity on the brain. And so the idea there is that this gravity is then interacting with some sort of CFT on the brain. And so if you have a full classical solution, if you look at it from the brain perspective, this is actually going to give you somehow a quantum corrected black hole. And so the cartoon there is giving one possible description, again, without any sort of backup at all, of how this might work. So on the left, we have a classical bulk picture. We've got a wee Schwarzschild black hole here, which is traveling along a geodesic. Geodesics in ADS space sort of curve away from what the sort of surface that represents our brain. So you could imagine this little black hole coming in, touching the brain, and then zooming off again. From the brain perspective, this might look like spherically symmetric collapsing matter, which forms a horizon, hangs around for a bit, and then eventually evaporates away. So this is the sort of picture from this holographic perspective.
Symmetric.
Said it was a cartoon, you know. I'm actually going to end up saying that I think this probably isn't the case. Okay. So you're absolutely right. You put your finger right on the main. You know, of course, it shouldn't be time symmetric. There's all sorts of issues involved, particularly about the black hole recoiling back off into the bulk and how it does that. So there's all sorts of issues, but you can actually weasel your way around them by saying, well, no, it's not time symmetric when you look at it in detail. But what happens is as the brain sort of come, you know, pulling away from the black hole, rather than it just coming off, you might get a sort of setup by which you're not well trained, you guys. We're trained at Durham to finish things. We always clean it up. So you have, this is your black hole, which somehow has some brain intercepting it. As the brain pulls off, you obviously can't come outside an event horizon again, but what somehow happens is an intercommutation type of process, right? So with strings, there's quite good evidence that this actually is a reasonable picture by looking at a cosmic string going through a black hole. But for walls, which these things are, it's slightly different. But this that would be the way you would get around your question if you were going to try and argue the case for the defense.
But you do picture the horizon touching the brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then what do you mean by horizon? You know, that's the other complication.
Are you suggesting there's some extension of the ADS CFT that involves gravity and
that's what the people who put forward this particular point of view, I think, are suggesting. So I'll say a bit more about that in very soon. Yeah. But that's exactly what they're suggesting. So just as a reminder, considering the conversation I was having before lunch, this next set of transparencies is going to be particularly apt. In four dimensions, we seem to have relatively good control on black holes. First of all, they're holes, they're spherical. This I've written down the Schwarzschild metric here, just simply because that's the simplest metric for a black hole. We also know that they're not really black. If we add in quantum effects, they actually have some thermodynamics. We know they radiate with a specific temperature inversely proportional to the mass. We know they have entropy proportional to the area of the horizon. And the horizon itself is sort of behaves a little bit like a soap bubble. It's something that has something like a surface tension, what we call surface gravity. We also know that they have relatively few quantum numbers in the sense of long-range charges, mass, angular momentum, and electromagnetic charge. We know as far as classical processes are concerned, the area of the event horizon increases. We also know that black holes can't bifurcate, and we get that essentially from an entropy argument. So we feel very confident about black holes in four dimensions. In five dimensions, this all seems to sort of go pear-shaped. So as far as Kaluza-Klein black holes are concerned, we do know how to form Kaluza-Klein black holes. We simply take a flat direction. The simplest one takes the Schwarzschild solution and just translates it in the extra dimension. So this would be the length of the extra dimension here. And there are also the general solution will also have possible boosting or spin, if you like, along the internal circle, that would be an electrically charged black hole, and then the magnetically charged black holes are formed by taking the circle, that is the Kaluza-Klein direction, and giving it a special sort of a twist as you glue it on over your four-dimensional space-time. And so we actually have a good set of solutions in five dimensions. Moreover, if you go to string theory, you get a similar picture, more fields, more charges, more dimensions, but it's the same idea. You have extended solutions as well as hole-type solutions. So it's the same sort of principle. They look very similar, although the details are different. However, when it comes to having theorems about black holes and extra dimensions, then things start to get a bit less pretty. We lose our uniqueness. We certainly lose our stability. These black strings are unstable. We don't even know the event horizon topology, because if if we have this is a hole, an S3, this is a string, S2 cross R. We've also got black rings now, S2 cross S1. So the story just becomes an awful lot more complicated. That's Kaluza-Klein extra dimensions. What about brain world extra dimensions? Well, in this case, we know even less. At least with Kaluza-Klein theory, we have the solutions, even if they weren't always stable or pretty. With brain worlds, we don't actually have any solutions. So, however, we believe that they should reflect the strongly localized nature of the brain. In other words, the black hole should either be right on the brain or just sticking a little bit out into the bulk. But we don't know if it's going to be spherical or hyperspherical. It doesn't have to be because of the strong localization on the brain. So we don't really know how it extends in the bulk or if it does. There's also the fact that it depends on how many extra dimensions there are as to what the solution would look like. Again, if we have one extra dimension for our brain, if we only have one extra dimension, we've got relatively good control in gravity. As soon as you add more, you end up just completely losing the plot.
So there's no known exact solution, is that what you're saying?
For one extra dimension, the only known exact solution is when you have two extra dimensions and you because a sort of co-dimension two brain is like a cosmic string, we know how to do cosmic string gravity. We just cut out a little wedge and re-identify. And so you take the six-dimensional Schwarzschild solution and cut out the wedge. But it's hardly rocket science, really, is it? So that's the only one that we know. Other than that, am I right there? Yeah, other than that, there is no fully self-consistent self-gravitating station. So what I want to do now is to get on to model specifics. So the scenario that I'm going to be talking about is called the Randall-Sundrum setup. This is a particularly popular brain world model because it's completely self-consistent gravitationally, and you can do calculations. So things can be self-consistent, but you may not be able to calculate anything, or you may be able to calculate something, but it's not self-consistent. Well, most of the time you can do both in the Randall-Sundrum case. So the setup here is we have five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space-time, and the brain cuts off that anti-de Sitter space-time at some particular radius. And just in case I want to do more on the board, so...
Just below the top, just underneath.
Yeah. Oh, it's this one. Okay. So that's so much, so... Car polishing cloth. So the brain is visualized as something which just cuts off the anti-de Sitter space at some point. In the simplest case, it simply cuts it off along a plane, some flat plane. So what I've drawn here is the representation of half the space-time. And so you have anti-de Sitter space with, which is strongly warped. So this is meant to represent this is meant to represent distances. This is my extra dimension, and I simply take two copies of that and glue them together. So this is what my warping looks like in the extra dimension. So if I write that down, this is my full bulk metric. You see that I have an extra dimension as advertised, the proper distance into, yeah.
Is this background is supported by the brain or?
No. So it's one of those sort of slightly counterintuitive things. So what you've got here in this bulk is you have a cosmological constant, which is negative. So that this bulk is strongly curved, and it's negatively curved because you have a negative cosmological constant.
Are you claiming that it's dual to the physics in the brain?
I'm not claiming anything yet. Yet. So at the moment, all I'm saying is I'm just setting up what the brain looks like. So first of all, I have to tell you what the space away from the brain is, which is actually the sitter space. And I'm writing it in a set of coordinates, you know, the Poincaré coordinates, in which you've got the parallel directions are space-time directions look flat. So I'm making my anti-de Sitter space by stacking up, you know, a whole sort of ream of paper, but where distances along the brain shrink exponentially rapidly as I move away into the bulk. And so...
This background is there to start with, or is the back action of the brains that you're putting in?
No. So this is the bulk, which has a negative cosmological constant, that's anti-de Sitter space, right? So what I do is I just cut the bulk off, right? If I cut this up here, and I take a mirror image, okay? This, although these two slices have the same internal dark sort of metric, when I glue them together, mm-hmm. I have to be going on this side from distances which are increasing over to this side where they're decreasing.
But this would not be a solution.
Okay. It is a solution. So
that's why the brain says.
Yeah, that's, give me a chance. So this what the brain is, when you try and stitch these things together, it costs you. You have to sort of make the space sort of fit together, and that's tension. So I mean, if you know, you won't have done any sewing, but if you had, you would know when you put two seams together that are curved and try and stitch them together, there's some tension involved. That tension is the brain. So the thing that's paradoxical, or what, you know, when you said, is the brain producing this bulk? The thing that's paradoxical is that when this brain is very flat and nothing is happening on it, it does, the bulk does not respond at all to the brain.
Negative strings from both sides, isn't it? Yeah. The brain is a negative tension?
No, it's got positive tension.
I guess what I mean has in mind by asking this question is that there is no object that you have to be supergravity or back to a supergravity. Those are precise things, the properties necessary to do this teaching.
For the random sum of your brain. Yes. Yes. Yes.
That's right. Yeah. So in the string series, there is no, you know, there is no effect of key breaking through which to the sets of properties like that. So you can do it in
string theory. This is not string theory. This is just
so all the framework that you're working in.
At the moment, all I'm doing is I'm just taking Einstein gravity. I've got anti de Sitter space. I've got Einstein gravity with a negative cosmological constant. I'm putting by hand, at the moment, by hand, a delta function source.
Made of what, some scale of field?
No, just a delta function source. So we imagine that it could represent a zero thickness limit of something, you know, sort of more complicated field theory. Mm-hmm. But from the gravitational perspective, if you have only one extra dimension, the bulk physics, the big picture, is relatively insensitive to the details of what goes on inside the brain. And so it's, if you like, it's a limit. It's an idealized description, but it's one which you can back up by showing that, you know, taking some finite thickness object, making it go infinitesimally thin, that you get the same picture, you know, I mean, that the essential physics away from the brain is the same. So this is not meant to be, it's not string theory, it's not consistent string theory. There's no extra charges in the bulk, there's no, you know, there's no sources in the sense that you think of them.
And you're not going to mention ADS-CFT.
Sorry?
You're not going to mention ADS-CFT.
I am going to mention ADS-CFT, but in a very, very sort of restricted context. So I'm going to mention it because that is the justification that the people that put forward this holographic idea, that's their justification for it. So I understand, just hold your skepticism for the moment, right? Hold the thought, okay?
It's probably fair to say that although string theorists don't know how to find this in string theory, they can't exclude it from string theory either. There may be some construction that looks like this in a long wavelength limit. Mm-hmm. Don't you think that's fair?
Well, you usually don't cut things off at finite radius, do you?
Supposing she could find that she could solve some interesting problem that motivated you to look for it in string theory. There's lots of solutions you don't know how to describe. No, maybe it's better.
Of course, you're right. Multi-throw compactifications will do precisely the same thing. The only comment is that you can't achieve that in superficial approximations. So inconsistent with the growth background. So
this model you can't, not this precise model, right? However, this model is something where you can do things concretely. And there is value in stripping away a lot of the extra detail in order to explore.
So you do it in this effective description, and I'm saying that this effective description could be invariably represented in string theory.
Sometimes.
The price you would pay is that you would end up having the regions which have strong coupling.
Sometimes you can. I mean, I guess this talk is a little. I can understand why you're having, trouble, but it's really from the Randall-Sundrum setup. It was not put forward initially from so much of a string theory motivated direction as being thinking more about the phenomenology. So at least that was my take on it, and certainly. A lot of the work that's been done on it is more from, not from a string perspective, but either exploring cosmology or exploring the phenomenology of it. So now that I understand what your objections are, I see where you're coming from, but just ride with it for the moment, okay? Just hold your horses. So,
attitude that this is a toy model that illustrates nice features, or do you think that maybe by 1% this is really where we did?
No, I think my view is it's a toy model. Oh. You're investigating what you can do with warp compactifications, and also it gives you an indication of what you may not be able to do with warp compactifications. So. In particular, a lot of the nice results rely on there being only one extra dimension. But, again, the fact that it's a toy model in which you can investigate the consequences of warped extra dimensions, it has had an influence on things that string theorists have been looking at.
I mean, the spirit of these questions is that you shouldn't be thinking about nuclei until you can derive it from QCD. I think that's not a reasonable point of view.
Mm, so I have to agree with that. Okay, so lightning, I'm going to speed up here for a bit. A lightning review just about gravity on these Randall Sundrum frames. So I've been saying this is all internally consistent. So why do I say that? First of all, because we can do perturbation theory on the Randall syndrome brain, it's you've got an infinite extra dimension in this picture that I drew here. And so you might think, well, hang on, why don't I get five-dimensional physics on my brain? Well, in fact, you don't, because when you do perturbation theory, you not only, what you do is you first of all perturb your bulk, and this is where some interaction is coming in, though probably not in the way you mean it. You have to do perturbation of the graviton in the bulk. In general, the brain will have rippled and moved. And so you have an additional possible degree of freedom, it's F, which represents how the brain is moved. So you allow your brain to go from this very flat form with this exact anti-disinter solution there, and you let the brain now will in general wiggle, and you may have some perturbed solution here. You then say, I let my, what I'm going to do is I'm going to straighten my brain, and then this is what I have left when I've done this process. So I've got something that is transverse trace free in four dimensions, that's your normal sort of spin two thing, and then you've got this extra scalar part. And then when you look at the full perturbation theory, in gravitational perturbation theory, you find that you get modes which from the brain's point of view look massive, like massive gravitons, so we call them groups of Klein modes, not surprisingly. But then the brain bending mode conspires with the zero mode, this transverse trace free part, the part which simply tracks this warp factor into the bulk, to give you the right tensor structure, in other words, exactly four-dimensional Einstein gravity. So this is why people like to work with Randall-Sundrum, because what you get in the long wavelength, well, long wavelength limit is precisely four-dimensional Einstein gravity. And so the picture is that if you thought about gravitational lines of force, initially these sort of spread out, not just on the brain, but into the extra dimension, but the warping of the anti-de-Sitter space pushes them back onto the brain. So the further away you go, the more four-dimensional you become. Calculating the corrections, you find they have a very specific form in terms of the wave number of the anti-de-Sitter curvature. So they're also power law corrections, not exponential corrections. So this is what you get for perturbative gravity.
I guess you're just using like a non-reaction for the, or whatever you would call it, for the brain? Or?
Well, actually, you're just doing gravitational perturbation theory. So the brain itself is just this delta function object. So it's just pure gravity. So yes, it would, sorry, that, yes. The answer is yes.
Yeah. The gravitational force is localized on the brain.
Yes.
So this does not explain why gravity is weak.
No, this is not going to end up giving a solution of the hierarchy problem. This particular one. Okay.
I was going to hate to bring in the word experiment. since we're in the Queen's Institute for Theoretical Physics. But the main experimental motivation for this model was the hierarchy problem solution to the standard particle physics. Mm-hmm. So whatever, we do have corrections to Newton, mm-hmm. but the latest experiments go way down in size, and we mm-hmm. haven't seen any corrections to Newton.
No, I haven't seen any corrections.
So what is the experimental, potential experimental motivation for all this?
I think it lies more in cosmology than in particle physics experiments, in the sense that if you want to try and think about the physics of the early universe, you should worry about extra dimensions. And so if you want to think about what the cosmological implications are for warped extra dimensions, this is something you can play with, something concrete, yeah?
You use the word, you should worry about extra dimensions. Why?
Well, again, if you believe that, if you actually believe in string theory as a way of unifying gravity, with particle physics, then you would be led to having extra dimensions. Yeah. No, I'm just saying, you know.
I don't disagree, just like it's ripped out.
So, okay. Right, well, cosmological brain worlds. I'm getting more and more. It's more fun, actually, when people ask these questions. But some of you for sure have things to go to. Right, so cosmological brain worlds. The other thing you can do with Randall syndrome is you can not do something non-perturbative, you can actually look at brain cosmology. And so in this case, we sort of build up in normal four-dimensional cosmology. You use homogeneity and isotropy to reduce the Einstein equations down to very manageable Friedman equation, and which you can solve, given an equation of state for matter. So in particular, you have the universe just simply being either open, flat, or closed, determined by some Kappa parameter, and you have a single scale factor, one dynamical variable. You go to brain worlds, you've now got two degrees of freedom, two directions on which your geometry can depend. You've got cosmological evolution in time, and you've also got the fact that things can vary out into the bulk. So in general, you might expect that you've introduced an extra degree of freedom in your metric. You can still make the spatial part constant curvature, but you might expect an extra degree of freedom. Since you want a general brain cosmology, you have to add energy momentum to the brain. The background solution has the energy equal to the tension, so that's a normal brain type energy momentum. But for cosmology, you have to add some energy density to E and subtract some pressure from T. So you go ahead, pop this into Einstein's equations and turn the handle. And it turns out that, in fact, even though you've added this extra degree of freedom, because your problem is essentially two-dimensional, you have this huge symmetry group, and it's this extra degree of freedom is simply a gauge degree of freedom. And so you find that you can solve the bulk precisely, and it's nothing other than a black hole space-time, a Schwarzschild antiquated space, and the cosmological brain is just a uniform distance away from the event horizon. So what I've sketched here is a closed universe, something that surrounds a hyperspherical black hole. And the sketch on the right-hand side has no black hole, but it's an example of what would be a de Sitter solution. So in this case, one way of constructing de Sitter space is by taking a hyperboloid in one dimension up. And in fact, what the brain world does is it makes that picture very real in the sense of the one dimension up is now the extra dimension. So your trajectory in the black hole space-time defines the scale factor. So as the brain moves, it expands or contracts. And if you go through the gravitational side of things, you find that you can get an implicit set of equations for this radial variable, which look very much like the Friedman equation. And so you start off the same way with h squared plus curvature term equals 8 pi g rho on 3, but then you get two additional terms, one of which just comes from the sort of matching across the brain, which depends on the energy squared, and the other term depends on the black hole in the bulk. And this is sometimes called dark radiation term. So this is where we're beginning to get to this holographic sort of aspect of things. So the effect of this black hole on the brain is to induce something that looks like a radiation term. And so it's all, even if the brain doesn't have any additional matter on it, it still looks as if it's got some radiation cosmology. And so this sort of led various people to sort of give some of the usual suspects at the bottom, to conjecture that this classical bulk solution was somehow related to a quantum corrected brain picture, brain gravity picture. So this is coming to a link which I can see, we've got a skeptic in the audience here. So I'm sort of probably on a lost cause here. So the basic rationale for why this picture of classical bulk solution, quantum corrector brain solution comes from, in a very loosened, loose sense, from this ADS-CFT correspondence. So we have our picture of the D-brain as being a surface on which open strings can end, our Dirichlet boundary condition. We also have a picture of the D-brain as being some solution in supergravity. So I've simply written down there the D3-brain solution. There are also fields in the bulk which, as far as Randall Sundrum is concerned, are not important. So what we then do is we take n to be large. We sort of go down near r equals 0. We look at our near horizon limit. And we can rewrite it as something which is beginning to look a little bit more connected to Randall Sundrum. So the L, this length scale, what we have here is simply ADS5 cross an S5 of uniform size L, where L is given in terms of this number of this stack of D3 brains. So where you have to suspend belief in terms of linking Randall Sundrum to this ADS-CFT picture is that you are ignoring this S5 here. So you're sort of kind of wiping that out, and you're looking at this ADS5 part. So that's the link, if you know. So we can, from my perspective as a brain world person, I need to know what my anti-de Sitter length scale is, and I need to know what my Newton's constant is. So the anti-de Sitter length scale is, you just read it off from the near horizon limit. I integrate out over the S5 to get my Newton's constant. And so I sort of have these classical quantities now given in terms of this sort of hypothetical string background. And Mike Duff pointed out that if you use this particular translation, that those corrections to the Newtonian potential, the 1 over r cubed corrections, actually corresponded exactly to some calculation he'd done in the 80s about one loop corrections to the graviton propagator. So in other words, the classical perturbative picture was somehow corresponding to some quantum correction that he had done. There was also Gubser, who did looked at the cosmology, and he sort of said, well, right, we've got a bulk black hole that's got a finite temperature associated with it. If I take the co-moving temperature on the brain, then that co-moving temperature is really looking like 1 over a to the fourth. And he sort of looked at this from a CFT point of view and found sort of agreement up to this 4/3 factor or 3/4. So again, he sort of said, well, maybe there's something deeper behind this. So I've already talked about that particular picture, so I won't go through it again, given the time is short. So this really led to what's known as the holographic conjecture. Tanaka first sort of had this idea that the reason that you couldn't find, people have been trying to find black hole solutions, the reason you couldn't find it is because it was dealing with back reaction of Hawking radiation. And Emperan, Fabry, and Kalliper formalized this with what they termed the holographic conjecture. And it was simply that a classical bulk solution corresponded to the quantum corrections from quantum gravity of a black hole. And they backed it up by looking at one dimension down, looking at problems in one dimension down. So yeah, I skated through it very fast. Sorry. So, well, so there isn't really an H. I mean, H bar is technically zero. So that should be, so that H there is meant to be an H bar. So really what they're relying on is not so much what plays the role of H bar in terms of the quantum correction, quantum corrected brain gravity, is this n squared H bar. So what you're really doing is you're letting n go to infinity and H bar go to zero in such a way that the combination n squared H bar remains finite. So even though the quantum corrections due to an individual mode would go away, because you've got infinitely many of them, the overall effect of the back reaction remains finite. So that's the argument of the holographic conjecture. Well, those are the modes of the, you know, the CFT. I'm damned if I can tell you what they are. I mean, I guess when Duff did the counting, he did actually have an explicit CFT in mind. So, however, and I gathered that this various objections to this holographic conjecture have been flying around, but the people who wrote them out were FRW, Fitzpatrick, Randall, and Wiseman, who argued that the holographic conjecture didn't work precisely because it wasn't, you know, in the all of those n squared states need not be accessible. So again, what you're really relating to classical gravity is a strongly coupled gauge theory, and you can't always access all of the degrees of freedom of the strongly coupled gauge theory. If you want an asymptotically flat black hole, you're asymptoting the vacuum, and so it would be like wanting to see a gluon outside the nucleus, is their argument. So, what we need in order to test this is, of course, an exact solution. And again, I'm going to give you now some arguments that have been the holographic conjecture people put forward to back up the picture. So the event horizon, well, I should be careful about calling it the horizon. On the brain world solution could potentially be static, or it could be time dependent. If it was static by the holographic conjecture, you would expect a singular horizon, because this is talking about your choice of vacuum on the brain. And so each of these would correspond to some singular static solution in the bulk, or possibly a time-dependent solution like that cartoon. Again, classical, that would give rise to a radiating black hole. Why is it difficult? Well, we know how that we sort of know how to deal in four dimensions with this type of problem, because as I said, geodesics, as far as the brain is concerned, accelerate away from the brain. So if a black hole is on the brain, it's actually in an accelerating frame of reference, just like we are here on the Earth. So we think of ourselves as being static, but we're not really. We're in an accelerating frame. We know how to find accelerating black holes in four dimensions. It's something called the C metric. But the problem is we don't know how to find them in five dimensions. And you sort of think, well, is it so different from the cosmological problem? You've got, you know, you've only got two dimensions that things depend on. Surely it's another sort of conformal problem. However, unlike cosmology, where you simply have one variable, one space, which has its own degree of freedom, here you've got two. You've got the time component, as well as the sort of spherically symmetric bit. And so essentially there's too much freedom to know what's happening there. Although I have to say the hunt for the C metric has had some nice side effects, because that was what Roberto and Harvey were trying to do when they found black rings. So maybe it wasn't such a bad thing. So there are sort of various different approaches that you can use, and at this point, I'm not going to say very much about any of them, but basically you could solve it numerically. Some people have taken a solution just looking in the brain, or another approach is to take a known bulk and slice it. So what is known? Well, the first attempt at doing a black hole was simply to put a black string to let the Schwarzschild solution extend out into the bulk, but of course that's not stable. Aha, say the holographic people. That doesn't matter, because we know a Schwarzschild black hole is not quantum mechanically stable. So maybe the classical instability corresponds to the thermodynamic instability of the black hole. But then, recently, Fabry and Procopio actually tried to sort of show that this is not so straightforward. So what they did was compare the timescales for the Hawking evaporation of the black hole. So that's essentially, if you've got just Hawking radiation, the rate of change of mass is proportional to 1 over m squared, with the sort of net effect of all these, the classical, classically unstable modes in the extra dimension. And so you can actually do, you can do this integral. You've got the instability itself has a time scale which is dependent on the mass of the Kaluza-Klein mode that's mediating the instability. But in fact, you can there's a sort of pretty close approximation, in fact, unnervingly close to this particular scale here. So you can do the integral, and the leading order term is proportional to 1 over m to the 3 halves, not 1 over m squared. So they're not the same beast. So this is sort of, you know, although initially the evidence looked good, you know, looked like things were fitting in, once you start picking away at the details, they start looking different. So to sort of get to the home stretch here.
Yeah. Gregory Laflamme is fast.
As n gets very small, it goes. The other one rockets away, right?
It depends on L. Depends on L.
N over L. N over L. G n over L.
Okay, so if the Schwarzschild radius is bigger or smaller than the ADS radius, that's the condition.
Yes, it looks big, doesn't it? Yeah, so initially, the classical one was faster, and then at the end, rockets away. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's see how fast I can get through this last bit. So what Simon and Raban and I decided to do was to try and test this, rather than in a case where you didn't have an exact solution, we wanted to test it in a case where you did have an exact solution. But the price that you paid was you went away from this exact Randall-Sundrum case, where the Randall-Sundrum background solution is flat, the braid tension is very finely tuned against the bulk cosmological constant. So you can detune this to form an anti-de Sitter brain, which is called a Karcher-angle brain, and you can sort of start to look at black hole solutions in anti-de Sitter space and say, well, how does the holography picture work then? So Karcher-angle brains, just to sort of show you how to construct them, initially, if you start with ADS in conformally flat coordinates, so normally you would have your boundary here at u equals zero. If instead you go to polar coordinates, sort of rather than straight forward going into the ADS space, then your Randall-Sundrum brain typically hits the boundary at a fixed angle. Now, these, I've put in two brains, you'll see why in the next slide or so, because I don't want to have the ADS boundary included in what I'm doing. I really want this to be a brain world picture. I want to have something going through the bulk of ADS. But both of these brains have positive tension. This is not like the original Randall-Sundrum model where you were worrying about hierarchy resolution, where you have two brains, one positive, one negative tension. It's not that. These are two brains, both with positive tension. So you can then, once you've done this transformation, you see that you've got your warp factor now depending, the overall warp factor depends on the angle in the bulk, and inside you've got ADS4. So the idea is to pop a black hole in that ADS4. Okay? So this is what it looks like from the bulk perspective. Here's the ADS boundary in blue. Here in black are these two anti-de Sitter brains which arc through the bulk of the ADS. What you then do is you put a black string going between the two positive tension brains. Now, for any black string, there's always this instability of the characteristic wavelength, but if you track through this distance through the bulk, it's finite. So you can, if you make the black hole big enough, it's classically stable. On the other hand, if you look at the four-dimensional picture, four-dimensional ADS black holes, they're similar to putting black holes in a box. If you've got a small black hole, it's unstable to Hawking radiation. But if you put a big black hole, it actually becomes stable. So this seems, again, consistent in the broad brush sense with the classical picture. However, the difference but here is if this black hole is now quantum mechanically stable, if we have a big black hole, we can actually calculate the back reaction of the radiation, or at least approximate it. And we can compare that with the classical result. So we can actually see whether there's a difference between the sort of standard semi-classical quantum field theory on the curved black ground picture and the sort of so-called strongly coupled gauge theory picture, or in other words, classical bulk gravity result. So this is what we did. The classical part, we know the classical solution. It looks as if there's no back reaction and nothing going on, because it's simply we take an ADS black hole, we translate it into the bulk. However, there is actually something going on, and that is because what you've got is still empty de Sitter space. It's not necessarily true that the cosmological constant, in other words, the difference between the critical round the sundry tension and the actual tension, is the same as the cosmological constant that you measure. So there's a few subtleties between actually doing this correct comparison, getting the right Newton's constant, for example. But you can go ahead and do this, and what you can actually see that there is an effect. You do actually have a shift in the cosmological constant. You can calculate what that is classically, and then re-express it in terms of these so-called ADS-CFT variables, in terms of N and the, you know, this is your sort of effective four-dimensional ADS scale. So what you're seeing here, there is an effect. It's proportional to h bar n squared, but it's also proportional to the four-dimensional anti de Sitter scale. So in other words, it's going to go to zero as you go to the Randall-Sundry limit. If you do the calculation trying to estimate what the effect of the sort of radiation gas around the black hole is, then you find that whilst there is a piece which is proportional to the energy momentum tensor, there's also some other terms. So it is not proportional to the background metric. And if you plot what the sort of weakly coupled stress energy momentum tensor is, you find this, the solid line is the energy, this is the radial, this is the azimuthal. In fact, they're all quite different. As you go to infinity, yes, they do go to a cosmological constant type of energy momentum tensor, but certainly near the horizon, they're quite different. So, in this one case, we certainly did not get the same result by comparing a quantum back reactor, brain back reactor calculation with the bulk classical result. Moreover, as I said, it does seem as if access to those n squared state disappears as you go to the asymptotically flat or Randall-Sundry limit. So I wrap up now, not too far over time, amazingly. Just simply saying that hopefully I've sort of at least, you know, explained why black holes are an interesting problem in terms of brain worlds. And at least I've given you some idea of what this holographic conjecture is. Now, you know, I don't care if you're skeptical, it's not my conjecture. but I do think it's this, that, you know, it is interesting. It's interesting because in so many ways, there do seem to be correspondences between something which is, I think, what was giving you trouble, something which is very much an empirical belt and braces working model, which is very simplistic, you know, and something which is coming from, a much more complex picture. And it's, in some ways, I would have liked the holographic conjecture to work, because it would be great if you had a way of computing, you know, corrections in quantum gravity, but it does seem as if, as if that is not the case. However, it's, the debate is far from over, so I'll just leave you with that.
They're all questioned out now.
Do you have any sort of explanation of what Mike Duff found? Because he did find this. Is it just a fluke, or is it dimensional analysis, or what is it?
That's a good question. Well, I suppose the people who really, who are sort of the holographic conjecture supporters, I think, want it to, I think they would view it that it would give a time-dependent answer, right? So they would want to have something which would correspond to an evaporating black hole. So whereas Mike Duff was definitely looking at a static solution, he was looking at the far field regime, right? So he's just looking at large R and looking for corrections at large R to the sort of Newtonian potential. So it may be that, you know, in that, that those, you know, those leading order corrections, that there is some, you know, some sense in which it works. But if you want to then continue on and have it, you know, right into the interior, right down to the black hole horizon, then, you know, that's a far stronger demand. So it's possible that, again, in certain limits, things seem to work. Because once again, you know, even what we found was a degree, well, I can't imagine, it was a, might have been a factor at large R. But again, but at least the this was tending. It was only near horizon that there was a difference. So, you know, it might be that if you're in certain limits, maybe, you know, things can look the same. But I think the holographic conjecture is meant to be much stronger than that. So. Yeah.
Is there any role for extrinsic curvature debate?
Well, that's an interesting question. You mean in terms of the finite width corrections, sort of looking at?
No, I was thinking more of modifying the action by putting a term in.
Yeah, that's this is someone coming from the topological defects slide. So when you find out finite width corrections, so in other words, extrinsic curvature corrections, usually if you're coming from the angle of these things being finite width physical objects, what you end up with, the next correction is the Ricci curvature, an induced curvature on the brain. So that is, of course, the what's called the DGP term, so Bali, Gavadaji, and Bharati. I mean, their model was very extreme, where they had only a Ricci term on the brain and no tension. But certainly you can do brain worlds with these induced curvature terms on them. However, if you want to put just extrinsic curvature terms, people haven't really done that much. So
the symmetries would allow for them.
Yeah, I know.
So it's not clear how to formulate the boundary value.
I sort of half thought about it at some point.
You're adding hydrolytics on the boundary, so it's.
Yeah, that's why I was sort of mentioned about the business with the, if you thought of them as finite width corrections and you were looking at it in a self-consistent approximation, you would only end up with a Ricci term. And so that would be something which you could put on in a self-consistent way. Normally, when you try and do just the pure k-squared terms, it tends to be a problem with the zero-width limit. But you say, what, there's a problem with actually assigning it? Because, I mean, I would have thought you could just write it down.
You can write it down, but if you look at the equations in motion,
you can't,
boundary conditions,
unless you've got the combination of constants which gives you the Ricci term. Because you can certainly put an induced Ricci term.
Yeah, the intrinsic things, of course, but the extrinsic.
All right. Well, that sort of fits with my finite width intuition.
Inconsistency in putting an extrinsic correlation? There's a correlation between, generally, if you write an effective action with boundary terms, then the things involving normal derivatives on the boundary coefficients that are tied to terms of the bulk, because when you vary the fields involved in the surface terms, which have to combine with the boundary action to give you variations that don't involve derivatives of the fields on the boundary. So if you just generate, if you integrate a heavy physics for the boundary, then the effective terms of the boundary, which are involved in normal derivatives, tend to come with couplings, which are correlated with couplings in the bulk. In the same way that we say the given talking one is correlated with the Einstein term.
So is that an inconsistency? Or?
Well, it would be if you just going to randomly put in arbitrary coefficients that were not related to each other.
I have a question about motivation. I mean, we know that in, say, if you want to do equilibrium statistical mechanics, quantum statistical mechanics in three dimensions, it's like doing a four-dimensional classical path integral. I'm just wondering, is there any connection to the motivation that's going on here, or?
Not for me. I wouldn't like to speak for everyone. I think for my motivation in looking at this is because, you know, I suppose I'm interested generally in the effects of extra dimensions, you know, on black hole type of solutions. And brain worlds are a very different way of having those extra dimensions. So my motivation is very simple. I just want to try and know what these things are and what they look like.
I'm not motivated for that conjecture.
I don't think so. No, I think those guys really were coming from the perspective of sort of ADS-CFT motivated.
Do they have a dictionary? I mean, you went through it
very quickly. I know.
So, I mean, how do you know what quantity that you calculate in the bulk corresponds to what quantity?
So, all I was doing was I was taking the D3 brain metric somewhere. It's very, very naive. It's wonderful. So, I took the D3 brain metric, and then I looked at where R was smaller than the radius of curvature, so so-called near horizon limit. So then I can identify what my anti-de-Sitter length scale is in terms of the sort of string scale and string coupling and n. So that gives me one of the quantities that I need. And then I needed the five-dimensional gravitational constant. And so to get that, I just did Richter pi reduction on the sphere. I mean, I think that's the flakiest bit, as from a motivational point of view, actually, getting down to Landau-Sundrum, is ignoring this whole, you know, effect of what, you know, what's happening on the spine. So.
Okay, then let me just quickly say that we are taking group to dinner tonight, if you're interested to join. Is 6 of people? Okay, let's say around 6. And we can continue the discussion, whoever wants to stay and whoever wants to go. And Ruth is going to be here for a few days at least, and her office is in 257. So, we're going to ask her any questions.
Shoot me later.